endangered species. Earth first. We'll log the other planets later. Two men sporting beards down to their sternums hover around the periphery, pointing shoulder-mount video cameras. A gray-haired woman in Danskins, felt fedora, and sleeveless vest tapes interviews with anyone who'll talk. Deeper into the trees, a man and woman with megaphones shape the crowd's mood. People, you're amazing! What a turnout! Thank you all! Ready for a walk in the woods? A cheer erupts, and the parade lurches down a gravel path toward the fresh skid road. Douglas falls into step, Mimi alongside. They weave into the colorful crowd, waving rainbow banners and shouting outrageous epithets. In the festive atmosphere, under so blue a sky, walking arm in arm with strangers up the slight grade, Mimi sees. For her entire life, unwittingly, she has complied with her parents' first shared principle, make no noise in this world. She, Carmen, Amelia, all three Ma girls, don't stand out. You have no right. No one owes you a thing. Keep small, vote mainstream, and nod like it all makes sense. Yet here she is, asking for trouble, acting like what she does might matter. They walk shoulder to shoulder across the skid road, 10 abreast, more rows deep than she can count. They sing tunes that Mimi last sang in summer camp in northern Illinois, songs of jingly childhood. This land is your land, if I had a hammer. Dougie smiles and hums along in a toneless bass. Between songs, a cheerleader with a megaphone, walking sideways near the front of the pack, stirs up some call and response. Clear cuts cost too much. Save our last stands. Righteousness makes Mimi nuts. She has always been allergic to people with conviction. But more than she hates conviction, she hates sneaky power. She has learned things about this mountainside that sicken her. A wealthy logging outfit, backed by a pro-industry forest circus, is exploiting the power vacuum prior to a big court decision by rushing through an illegal grab of mixed conifers that have been growing for centuries before the idea of ownership came to these parts. She's ready to try anything to slow theft down, even righteousness. They hike through dense spruce for the length of three choruses. Trunks slice the sunlight into shards. Godfingers, she and her sisters used to call those slanted beams. Trees she can't name shoot up all around, wrapped in vines, or tumbling to the ground like barricades. So much life in so many flavors she wants to strip down and scamper. The understory is shot through with saplings she could encircle with her fist, broomsticks that may have bidden their time for 100 years. But the canopy is carried by trunks that several arm-linked protesters still could not hug. Vistas open up through the green crenellations. Mimi tugs Doug's sleeve and points. To the northeast, down ravines and up slopes too steep to walk, a pincushion of health rolls over the hills. Fog wraps the tops of the firs the way it did on the day the first European ships sniffed out harbors on this coast. But through another gap to the south, lunar devastation runs up the mountainside. Slash, doused with diesel and burnt until even the fungus is dead, then drowned with herbicide so nothing will grow again but this company's monocrop row plantations in a short cycle that, she has learned, will last only a few more rounds at most before the soil is dead. From on high, it feels as if even the trees spreading across these slopes are at war. Patches of lush green march against patches of muddy vomit all the way to the horizon. And the people assembled here, ignorant armies going up against each other as they have forever, for reasons hidden from even the most vehement. When will it be enough? Now, If you can believe this chanting, laughing crowd on its way to convince the road crew at the end of these wheel ruts. Now, the second best of times. The road narrows, and the emerald forest thickens. Monster trunks dwarf and disorient Mimi. Moss grows up and over everything in thick blankets. Even the ferns reach to her breasts. The man beside her knows the names of trees, but Mimi is too proud to ask for IDs. Despite a decade of living in this state, despite repeated attempts to master the field guides and dichotomous keys, she can't tell a limber from a sugar pine, let alone a Port Orford from an incense cedar. Silver, white, red, and grand firs are all a frilly blur. And the swarming understory. Impossible. Salal, somehow, she knows. Oxalis and Trillium. But the rest is a tossed salad of inscrutable foliage, creeping up to trailside, ready to grab her ankles. Douglas points off to the left of the road.
Look!
In the middle of the blue-green confusion, seven stout trees grow in a line as straight as Euclid's daydreams. How the hell? Did someone... He laughs and pats her shoulder. The touch feels good.
Think back. Think way back.
She does and sees nothing. Douglas milks the suspense a little longer.
Few hundred years ago, right around the time the pilgrims were thinking, what the fuck, huh? Let's go for it. Some big monster fell. Log rot's a perfect seedbed. Bunch of seedlings used it as a furrow. Like God sowed them in with a hoe.
Something glints in front of her, revealed by the dappled light, the way dew betrays a spider web. Tight nets of tens of thousands of species knit together in weaves too fine for any person to trace. Who knows what medicines might be hidden here? The next aspirin, the next quinine, the next Taxol. Reason enough that this last little stand should stay intact a little longer.
Something, isn't it?
Is, Dougals. This man tried to save her pines. Put his body between the saws and the trees. She wouldn't be out here, even in this endangered paradise, without him. But for her money, he's more than a little whacked. His rangy gameness for anything scares her. The twinkle he fixes on the forest ahead has that look of the not entirely housebroken. His head swivels, marveling at the crowd, happy as a puppy to be let back in the house.
"Hear that?" Douglas asks.
But she has heard it all morning. In another quarter mile, the dull whine sharpens. Down the road, through the brambles, mustard and orange machines claw the earth, graders and scrapers pushing this road into new territory.
"Ah, jeez, Mimi. Look what they're doing to this beautiful place. What they do!"
The protesters reach a gate of welded metal bars across the road. The advance guard stops at the obstacle, and the banners pool around them. The megaphone woman says, "We're about to cross over into the cut. This will be an encroachment of the timber plan we're contesting. Those of you who are unwilling to be arrested, remain here. Your presence and voices are still important. The press is taking notice of your feelings." Applause, like the flutter of grouse.
"Those willing to head on, thank you. We'll cross now. Stay orderly, stay calm. Do not allow yourself to be provoked. This is a peaceful confrontation."
A portion of the crowd drifts toward the gate. Mimi cocks an eyebrow at Douglas. "You're sure?"
"Shit, yeah. That's why we're here, isn't it?"
She wonders if he means here on the edge of a national forest being sold to the top bidder, or here On Earth, the only entity capable of prospection. She shrugs away all philosophy.
Let's go!
10 more yards, and they're criminals. The roar grows sickening. In half a mile, they're up against human ingenuity at its best. She can name the metal beasts better than she can name the different trees. Down through the clearing, there's a feller buncher, snatching batches of small trunks, delimbing them, and bucking the logs to fixed lengths, doing in a day what a team of human cutters would need a week to get through. There's a self-loading forwarder trailer, stacking the cut logs into itself. Nearer by, a front loader extends the roadbed, and a scraper rough grades it prior to the arrival of the roller. She's learned of machines that drop their maws onto 50-foot trees and grind them to the ground faster than a food processor can shred a carrot. Machines that stack logs like toothpicks and haul them to mills where 20-foot trunks twirl on spits so fast that the touch of an angled blade shaves off the flesh in a continuous layer of veneer. Hard hats block the road ahead of them. Their foreman says,
"You're trespassing."
The megaphone woman, on whom Mimi has developed a schoolgirl crush, says, "These are public lands." The other megaphone wielder gives the command, and marchers fan out across the dirt roadbed. They sit down, shoulder to shoulder, spanning the road. Mimi and Doug link arms, joining the solidifying line. Mimi locks in, clasping her hands in front of her. The inward-turned mulberry of her jade ring presses into her other wrist. By the time the loggers see what's happening, the deed is done. The two ends of the human chain lock themselves with bike cables to trees on either side of the road. Two fellers walk right up to the arm-locked line. The tops of their steel-reinforced boots come almost to Mimi's eyes.
"Shit,"
a blonde one says. Mimi sees his genuine distress.
"When are you people going to grow up and get real? Why don't you take care of your own business and let us get on with ours?" "This is everybody's business," Douglas answers.
Mimi tugs at him.
"You know where the real problems are? Brazil, China. That's where the crazy cutting is. You should go protest down there. See what they think when you tell them they can't get as rich as we are."
"You're cutting down the last American old growth."
"You wouldn't know old growth if it fell on you. We've been cutting these hillsides for decades, and we've been replanting 10 trees for each one we cut."
"Correction. I've been replanting 10 little paper pulp seedlings for each one of these varied ancient geniuses." Mimi watches the foreman make all kinds of cost-benefit calculations. It's a funny thing about capitalism. Money you lose by slowing down is always more important than money you've already made. One of the fellers swings his boot and flicks a pad of mud up into Douglas's face. Mimi loosens her arm to clean it off, but Doug clasps her in his bicep. Another fleck of mud.
"Oh, sorry, guy. My mistake."
Mimi interrupts.
"You punk thug!
Take it up with these guys. Sue me from your jail cell." The feller points off behind the seated line where police are pouring down the Forest Service road in force. They break the chain like someone plucking a dandelion. Then they handcuff the broken links back together. Mimi and Douglas end up with two strangers chained between them and two more on each side. They're left to sit in the muddy road while the police mop up the chaos.
"I need to pee," Mimi tells a cop around 2 o'clock.
Half an hour later, she tells the same cop again, "I really, really need to urinate."
"No, you don't. You really don't."
Urine leaks down her leg. She starts sobbing. The women she's cuffed to gag and grimace.
"I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I couldn't hold it."
Shh. It's okay, Douglas says, handcuffed two bodies down. Don't think about it.
Her sobs get frantic.
It's okay, Douglas keeps saying. I've got my arm around you, in my head.
The crying stops. It won't start up again for years. Smelling like an animal-marked stump, Mimi submits to arrest and booking. As the lady officer in the station takes her fingerprints, she feels, for the first time since her father's death, like she's given the day everything it wanted. The kiss comes down on the crown of Ray's head from behind, where he sits in his study reading. Kisses, brisk and precise, like wire-guided bomblets, are Dorothy's trademark these days. It never fails to make his blood run cold.
Off to sing!
He cranes to look at her. She's 44, but looks to him as she did at 28. It's the not having babies, he thinks, the bloom still coursing through her, the pure lure, as if ridiculous loveliness still had a job to do this far past youth. Jeans and a white cotton blouse gathered in pleats that cling to her plaintive ribs. Topped with a lilac shawl, sweetly disheveled and swept across her neck, the one stretch of skin she thinks betrays her. Her hair falls on the shawl, shiny, chestnut, perfect, still the length it was when she tried out for Lady Macbeth on their first date.
You look so beautiful.
Ha! Huh, I'm glad your eyes are failing.
She tickles the spot where her kiss landed. Thinning up here.
Time's winged chariot.
I'm trying to picture such a vehicle. How would that work, exactly? He cranes further. Clasped in one hand against her runner's thighs, she holds a pale green Peter's edition, emblazoned with the giant black word, Brahms, broken in two by her perfect forearm. Beneath that, smaller, Ein Deutsches Requiem. The concert is at the end of June. She'll stand on stage with 100 other voices, inconspicuous among the women except for being one of the few who are not yet gray, and sing,
Siehe, ein Ackermann wartet auf die köstliche Frucht der Erde und ist geduldig darüber, bis empfahe den Morgenregen und Abendregen.
Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Singing is now everything. It follows on a line of hobbies she has hit hard in the hopes of passing the week as maximally as possible. Swimming, life-saving, life-drawing in charcoal and pastels. Meanwhile, he has withdrawn into the stronghold of his study. He bills more hours of work than ever, in the vague hope of buying a second home for them, someplace more beautiful, someplace surrounded, if not by wilderness, then by the memory of it.
Lots of rehearsals.
2 2-hour rehearsals every week, and she hasn't missed one.
They're fun.
She has been overprepared for weeks. Truth is, she has practiced so hard at home that she could sing this piece tonight from start to finish, every vocal line.
Sure you don't want to come? We need more basses.
More than ever, she astonishes him. What would she do if he said yes?
Maybe in the fall, for the Mozart.
You've got enough to keep you busy?
This is what people do. Solve their own problems in others' lives. He laughs.
At the moment, yes. I'm wrestling with this.
He holds the pages up to her.
Should Trees Have Standing?
She reads the title and frowns. Ray examines the words, puzzled himself.
He seems to be saying that the law's shortfall is that it only recognizes human victims.
And that's a problem?
He wants to extend rights to non-human things. He wants trees to be rewarded for their intellectual property. She smirks.
Bad for business, huh?
I don't know whether to throw it across the room and laugh, or to set it on fire and kill myself.
Let me know which you decide. See you between 10 and 11. Don't wait up if you're sleepy.
I'm sleepy already. He laughs again as if he just made a joke. You warm enough? It's going to get chilly. Button up your overcoat. She seizes up in the doorway, and the moment is there again between them. The sudden upwell of anger and mutual defeat. I'm not your property, Ray. We had a deal.
What is this? I didn't say you were my property.
You certainly did, she says, and is gone. Only when the door hammers shut does he make the leap. Overcoats, buttons, wind blowing free. Take good care of yourself. You belong to me. She drives off down Birch to the west under orange maples. He doesn't bother to watch the taillights or see where she turns. It would be an indignity to them both. She's too smart not to drive past the rehearsal auditorium first. Besides, he's already stood at the window on previous nights and watched the taillights. He's done it all. All things desperate and disgusting. Looked up the unknown numbers on the phone bill log. Checked the pockets of her previous night's clothes. Gone through her purse for notes. He finds no notes. Just courtroom exhibits A through Z of his shame. His weeks of disbelief long ago changed into a free fall many times scarier than their youthful stint at skydiving. The panic of discovery soon thickened into grief, the kind he felt when his mother died. Then grief transmuted into virtue, which he nursed in secrecy for weeks, until virtue collapsed under its own explosive growth into bitter immobility. Every question is a voluntary madness. Who? Why? How long? How often before? What does it matter? Leave your overcoat unbuttoned. Now he just wants peace and to be near her a little longer, for as long as he can, before she smashes everything just to punish him for finding out. She parks her car in the lot behind the auditorium. She even goes in for a minute. Not so much to establish an alibi as to make the trap door that opens under her feel that much crazier. When the 100 singers mill onto the risers, she slips out the back as if to retrieve something she left in her car. In a minute, she's on the rain-slicked street, cold, living, heart beating like mad. She's going to get done. Several different ways, long and lovingly and to no purpose, with no contractual obligations, by a man she doesn't know from Adam. The thought runs the length of her, like she just injected something. She's going to be bad. Bad again. Stupid bad. Do things she never imagined she could do. New things. Going to learn more about herself, scary more, at high speed, joyously. What she likes and doesn't, when she isn't lying the lazy lie of decency. Put the last 30 years to the heat-freeing flames. The thought shatters her. Magic. Growth. And she's damp and practically coming from the swish of her own legs, like a pith-green girl of 16 by the time she sees the black BMW at curbside and lets herself in. 48 minutes of wilderness experiment. Immediately afterward, she has trouble remembering. Like maybe he did drug her just a little, for fun. She remembers sitting up on her spread knees on the giant bed, giggling like a blitzed sorority princess. She remembers growing huge, poetic, queenly, godlike, a flood of Brahms. then falling back into the pain in her legs and lungs, a distance runner. She remembers him whispering in her ear as he fingered her, vague, threatening, worshipful, thrilling syllables that she fed on without quite making out. Every so often in the bobbing sea, as they did the week before, details from her favorite adultery novels flashed in her head with horrible specificity. She remembers thinking, "Now I'm the heroine of my own doomed story." Then a long and tender kiss goodnight, curbside in the dark car, 3 blocks from the auditorium. 10 steps down the slick sidewalk, she consigns the whole adventure to imagination, something that happened only in a book. She's back inside and up on the risers with time to spare, waiting for the return of the choral swell as the baritone sings, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye." Ray nibbles on dinner, pistachios and an apple. Reading is slow and all things distract him. Staring at the bottom of the apple's core, he realizes that the calyx, a word he'll never know in this life, is nothing less than the leftover bits of a withered apple flower. He looks up from the thicket of words 3 times a minute, waiting for truth to hit like a falling oak smashing through the house's roof. Nothing comes to kill him. Nothing at all happens, and it keeps on happening with great force and patience. Nothing happens so completely that when he checks his watch to see why Dorothy isn't home yet, he's stunned to discover that less than 30 minutes has passed. He bows his head and fixes on the page. The article stokes his distress. Should trees have standing? This time last month it would have been his evening's great sport to test the ingenious argument. What can be owned, and who can do the owning? What conveys a right, and why should humans alone on all the planet have them? But tonight the words swim. 8:37. Everything that was his is going down, and he doesn't even know what brought on disaster. The terrible logic of the essay begins to wear him down. Children, women, slaves, aboriginals, the ill, insane, and disabled, all changed unthinkably over the centuries into persons by the law. So why shouldn't trees and eagles and rivers and living mountains be able to sue humans for theft and endless damages? The whole idea is a holy nightmare. A death dance of justice, like the one he now lives through, watching the second hand of his watch refuse to move. His entire career until this moment, protecting the property of those with a right to grow, begins to seem like one long war crime, like something he'll be imprisoned for come the revolution. "The proposal is bound to sound odd, or frightening, or laughable. This is partly because until the rightless thing receives its rights, we cannot see it as anything but a thing for the use of us, those who are holding rights at the time." 8:42, and he's desperate. He'll do anything now to deceive her, to make her think he has no idea. Her fit of craziness will run its course. The fever that has turned her into someone he can't recognize will burn away and leave her well again. Shame will bring her back to herself, and she'll remember everything. The years, the time they went to Italy, the time they jumped from the plane, the time she ran the car into a tree while reading his anniversary letter and almost killed herself, the amateur theatrics, the things they planted together, in the backyard they made. It is no answer to say that streams and forests cannot have standing because streams and forests cannot speak. Corporations cannot speak either, nor can states, estates, infants, incompetents, municipalities, or universities. Lawyers speak for them. The key thing is for her never to learn that he knows. He must be cheerful, smart, funny. The minute she suspects, it'll destroy them both. She might live with anything except being forgiven. But concealment is killing him. He never could play anyone but an Ernest Macduff. 8:48. He tries to concentrate. The evening stretches out ahead like two consecutive life sentences. He has only this essay to keep him company and torture him. What is it within us that gives us this need not just to satisfy basic biological wants, but to extend our wills over things, to objectify them, to make them ours, to manipulate them, to keep them at a psychic distance? The essay flickers under his fingers. He can't follow it, can't decide whether it's brilliant or rubbish. His whole self is dissolving. All his rights and privileges, everything he owns. A great gift that has been his since birth is being taken away. It's a grand, luxurious act of self-deceit, an outright lie, that claim of Kant's. As far as non-humans are concerned, we have no direct duties. All exists merely as means to an end. That end is man. Disgust breaks over her as she drives home. But even disgust feels like freedom. If a person can see the worst in herself, if a person can find total honesty, complete knowledge of what she really is, now that she's sated, she wants purity again. At the light at Snelling, she looks up into the rearview mirror and sees her eyes hiding from her own furtive glance. She thinks, I'll stop. Get my life back. Decency. This doesn't have to end in a flaming fireball. The coming concert performance can absorb her excess energy. After that, she'll find something else to occupy her, to keep her sane and sober. By Lexington, 10 blocks down, she's planning one more dose. Just one more, to remind her what it feels like to ski this mountain continent. She won't be pathetic. She'll have the addiction without the pitiful resolutions. She doesn't know what's addicted, her body or her will. She knows only that she'll follow herself down to wherever it takes her. By the time she turns onto their street's leafy canyon, she's calm again. She comes in rosy from the cold. Her scarf trails as she pushes the door shut behind her. The Requiem score drops from her hands. She bends to pick it up, and when she straightens, their eyes catch, spilling everything. Scared, defiant, pleading, thuggish. Wanting to be home again with an old friend.
Hey! You haven't budged from that chair!
Good rehearsal?
The best!
I'm glad. What sections did you sing? She crosses to where he sits, something of their old rhythm. She hugs him,
ziemlich langsam und mit Ausdruck.
Before he can stand, she slips past into the kitchen, smelling on herself that blend of salt and bleach.
I'll just take a quick shower before bed.
She's a smart woman, but she has never had much patience with the obvious, nor does she think him capable of simple observation. She showered 20 minutes before heading out to sing her Brahms. In bed, in peacock pajamas, scalded and renewed from the hot spray, she asks, "How's the reading?" He needs a moment to remember what he spent all night trying to read. "What is needed is a myth." "Difficult. I wasn't all there."
"Hmm."
She rolls on her side to face him, eyes closed.
"Tell me."
"I do not think it too remote that we may come to regard the earth, as some have suggested, as one organism, of which mankind is a functional part. The mind, perhaps." He wants to give rights to everything alive. He claims that paying trees for their creative invention would make the whole world richer. If he's right, then our entire social system, everything I've ever worked for... But her breathing has changed, and she floats away like a newborn after a day of first discoveries. He douses the bedside light and turns away from her. Still, she murmurs in her sleep and grapples to him, clutching his backside for whatever warmth he generates, her bare arms on him, the woman he fell in love with, the woman he married, funny, manic, wild, untamable Lady Macbeth, lover of sprawling novels, jumper from airplanes, the best amateur actress he has ever known. Watchman and Maidenhair, deep in the redwoods. He lugs a pack of provisions. She holds the camp's video camera in one hand. With her other, she clutches his arm like a channel swimmer hanging from a dinghy. Now and then she grabs his wrist, directing his attention to something colorful or darting just outside their comprehension. Last night they slept on the cold ground, open to the air. Seas of mud moated their fern-fringed island. He lay in one pea-stained 1950s sleeping bag, and she in another, underneath creatures of mildness, bulk, and repose. "Aren't you freezing?" he asked. She answered no, and he believed her. "Sore?" "Not really." "Scared?" Her eyes said, "Why?" Her mouth said, "Should we be?" "They're so big. Humboldt Timber employs hundreds of people, thousands of machines. It's owned by a multi-billion-dollar multinational. All the laws are on their side, backed by the will of the American people. We're a bunch of unemployed vandals camping out in the woods." She smiled, as at a little kid who just asked whether the Chinese could reach them through a tunnel in the earth. Her hand snaked out of her bag and into his. "Believe me, I have it on the highest authority. Great things are underway." Her hand stayed between them, like a traverse line, as she fell asleep. They follow a switchback down into a distant drainage until the path turns into a rivulet of mud. 2 miles in, the trail vanishes, and the two of them must bushwhack. Light sifts through the canopy. He watches her cross a carpet of starflower massed with sorrel. Mere months ago, by her own account, she was a nasty, jaded, narcissistic bitch with a substance abuse problem, flunking out of college. Now she's... what? Something at peace with being human, in league with something very much not. The redwoods do strange things. They hum. They radiate arcs of force. Their burls spill out in enchanted shapes. She grabs his shoulder. "Look at that!" 12 apostle trees stand in a fairy ring as perfect as the circles little Nicky once drew with a protractor on rainy Sundays decades ago. Centuries after their ancestors' death, 12 basal clones surround the empty center, all around the compass rose. A chemical semaphore passes through Nick's brain. Suppose a person had sculpted any one of these just as they stand. That single work would be a landmark of human art. Alongside the Pebbly Creek, they come to a downed giant that even sideways is taller than Olivia. "We're here." "Just to the right," Mother N said. "This way." He sees it first, a grove of trunks 600 years old, running upward out of sight. The pillars of a russet cathedral nave, trees older than movable type. But their furrows are spray-painted with white numbers, like someone tattooed a living cow with a butcher diagram showing the various cuts of meat hidden underneath. Orders for a massacre. Olivia lifts the handycam to her face and films. Nick slips off his backpack, floats weightless for a few steps. A rainbow of spray cans comes from his pack. He lays them in a patch of young horsetails. Half a dozen colors from across the spectrum. Cherry in one hand, lemon in the other. He wanders toward a marked tree. He studies the white strokes already there. Then he lifts the can and sprays. Later, her video will be edited, fitted out with voiceover, and sent to every sympathetic journalist in the Life Defense Force address book. For now, the soundtrack is the 100 cries of the forest, punctuated by awe. How do you do that? Up close to the microphone. Nick returns to his palette on the forest floor and picks two more hues. He paints, then steps back to appraise his handiwork. The species are as wild as any that inhabit a museum's collection cabinet. He goes on to the next numeral-defaced tree and starts again. Soon enough, the numbers disappear past recognition into butterflies. He graduates to those trunks marked by a simple blue tick. They're everywhere, these death sentences made with a simple stroke. Then he proceeds to paint those trees with no markings at all, until it's impossible to say which trunks have been slated for cutting and which are mere bystanders. The afternoon vanishes. They've both been on forest time too long to count in mere hours anymore. The work is over in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Olivia pans the camera around the transformed grove. Where there had been measurements and prospects, a project of hard numbers, there are now only skippers and swallowtails, morphos, hair streaks, and heaths. It could be a grove of sacred firs in the Mexican mountains, where Tiffany insects stage their many-generation migration. Thus, two people in an afternoon undo a week's work of appraisers and surveyors. The voice on the unedited video says, "They'll be back." He means the numbers men, to mark their culls again in a more foolproof way. "But this is beautiful. It'll cost them." Maybe. Or the lumber shows will just come in and take everything, like they did at Merlet Grove. "We have film now." You can hear it in the music of her recorded voice, the belief that affection might solve the problems of freedom yet. Then the film cuts to black. No one sees what happens next between the two humans, there on the forest floor, between the banks of fern and Solomon's seal. No one, unless you count the countless invisible creatures burrowing beneath the soil, crawling under the bark, crouching in the branches, climbing and leaping and banking through the canopy. Even the giant trees breathe in the few molecules per billion of homecoming dispensed into the air. Patricia hears from a quarter mile away, Dennis's truck thumping down the gravel washboard road. The sound gladdens her, glad before she knows she's glad. In its way, the crunch and whir lift her as much as the wheezy cheep of a Townsend's warbler skirting the edge of a clearing. The truck is its own wildlife rarity, although this creature appears every day as punctual as the rain. She drifts down to the road, feeling how edgy her weight has been these last 20 minutes. He'll have lunch, yes, and the mail, her mixed bag of connections with the outside world, new data from the lab in Corvallis. But Dennis, that's the installment her soul now needs. He steadies her, his listening, and she wonders with delighted horror whether 22 hours might be too long to go between sightings. She comes up close to the halted truck and must step back when he opens the cab. His broad arm swings around her waist, and he nuzzles her neck. Den, my favorite mammal.
Babe, wait till you see what we're having.
He hands her the mail and grabs the cooler. They climb the slope to the cabin, shoulder to shoulder, at peace with each other in silence. She sits on the porch at the cable spool table, thumbing through the mail as he unpacks lunch. How can the masterful duplicity, important information about your insurance, open at once, find her even here? She has lived far from commerce for decades, and yet her name is a hot commodity, bought and sold endlessly as she sits in her cabin reading Thoreau. She hopes the buyers aren't paying much. No. She hopes they're being extorted. Nothing from Corvallis, but there's a packet from her agent. She sets it down on the wooden slats next to her plate. It's still there when Dennis brings out two small, magnificent stuffed rainbow trout.
Everything okay?
She nods and shakes her head all at once.
No bad news, is there?
No. I don't know. I can't open it. He doles out the fish and picks up the packet.
It's from Jackie. What's to be afraid of?
She doesn't know. Lawsuits, chastisements, official business. Open at once. He hands her the envelope and flicks the air, nudging her courage. You're good for me, Dennis. She slips her finger under the sealed lip, and many things spill out. Reviews, forwarded fan mail, a letter from Jackie with a check paperclip to it. She sees the check and yelps. The paper falls to the ground and lands face down in the always damp earth. Dennis retrieves the check and wipes it clean. He whistles.
Jeepers!
He looks at her, eyebrows high.
Misplaced a decimal point there, did they?
Two places. He laughs, his shoulders shuddering, like his antique truck trying to turn over after a night below freezing.
She told you the book was doing well.
There's a mistake. We have to pay it back.
You made a good thing, Patty. People like good things.
It isn't possible.
Don't get excited. It's not that much.
But it is. It's more than she has ever had in any bank her whole life. The money's not mine.
What do you mean it's not yours? You worked on that book for 7 years.
She doesn't hear him. She's listening to the wind coming through the alders.
You can always give it away. Write a check to American Forests. Or maybe to that Chestnut Backcross Recovery Program. You could invest it in the research team. Come on, eat your fish now. Took me 2 hours to catch these guys.
After lunch, he reads her the reviews. Somehow, in Dennis's radio baritone, they sound mostly good. Appreciative. People say, I didn't realize. People say, I've started seeing things. Then he reads her the reader's letters. Some of them just want to thank her. Some of them confuse her with the mother of all trees. Some of them make her feel like Miss Lonely Hearts.
I have a big burr oak in our backyard that must be 200 years old. Last spring, one side of it started to sicken. It's killing me to watch it die in slow motion. What can I do?
Many mention the giving trees, those ancient Douglas firs that, with their last act, give all their secondary metabolites back to the community.
Hear that, babe? You've made me think about life in a different way. That might be a compliment.
She laughs, but it sounds like a bobcat caught in a snare.
Oh, now here's something. A request to go on the most listened-to public radio program in the country. They're doing a series on the planet's future, and they need someone to speak for the trees.
She hears his words from high up in a Douglas fir in the middle of a howling storm. human industry everywhere. People need things from her. People mistake her for someone else. People mean to drag her violently back into what people mistakenly call the world. Moses comes into base camp frazzled. Actions everywhere, and they've lost 13 people to detention and arrest in the last half week.
We've got a legacy tree sit that needs manning. Anyone up for a brief stint up top?
Maidenhair's hand shoots into the air before Watchman even understands the request. Such a look crosses her face.
Yes, this, at last.
You sure? Moses asks,
as if he hasn't just fulfilled the Voices of Light's predictions.
You'll be up there for at least a few days.
She assures Nick while she packs,
If you think you can do more from down here, I'll be fine by myself. They wouldn't dare hurt me. Think of the press.
He won't be fine, except where she is. It's that simple, that absurd. He doesn't tell her. The thing is so screamingly obvious, even in the way he hovers and nods. Of course she knows. She can hear beings that aren't even here. Of course she can hear his banging thoughts, the blood pounding in his ears, even above the endless rain. Their packs go up and over the gate first. Then they follow. Maidenhair, Watchman, and their guide, Loki, who has run ground support for this tree for weeks. Their feet come back down in humble timber territory, trespass with criminal intent. The packs are heavy and the path steep. Weeks of steady rain have turned the trail to Turkish coffee. Weeks ago, they wouldn't have made it to mile 3. Even now, 5 miles in, Watchman sucks air in great gulps. He's ashamed and falls back on the trail, where she can't hear him wheeze. The path ascends a sloppy escarpment. The weight of the pack and the foot-sucking muck pull him down until every step is a pole vault. He stops to catch his breath, and the sleety air goes through him. Up ahead, Maidenhair forges on like some mythic beast. Power rises into her feet from the needle-bedded ground. Each mud-coated plunge renews her. She's dancing. Cowardice adds several stones to Nick's pack. He doesn't want to get arrested. He's not crazy about heights. He has only love to drive him up the cliff face. She's fueled by the need to save everything alive. Loki puts out his palm.
See that flashing light?
Buzzard and sparks. They hear us. He cups his hand to his lips and hoots. The light up in the high forest flashes again, impatient. This, too, makes Loki laugh.
Those bastards can't wait to get back down to Earth. Can you tell?
Nick is ready himself, and he hasn't even left the ground. They slog the last few hundred yards up the rut. A profile emerges out of the thicket. So huge, it can't be right.
There it is,
Loki says pointlessly.
There's Mimas.
Sounds come up and out of Nick's mouth, syllables that mean, loosely, Oh, my hopeless Jesus. He has seen monster trees for weeks, but never one like this. Mimas. Wider across than his great-great-great-grandfather's old farmhouse. Here, as sundown blankets them, the feel is primeval. Darshan, a face-to-face intro to divinity. The tree runs straight up like a chimney butte and neglects to stop. From underneath, it could be Yggdrasil, the world tree, with its roots in the underworld and crown in the world above. 25 feet above ground, a secondary trunk springs out of the expanse of flank, a branch bigger than the whole chestnut. 2 more trunks flare out higher up the main shaft. The whole ensemble looks like some exercise in cladistics, the evolutionary tree of life. One great idea splintering into whole new family branches, high up in the run of long time. Watchman humps up to where Maidenhair stands, gazing, wondering if it's too late to back out. But even in the falling light, her face glows with cause. All the agitation that has been such a part of her since she pulled into his gravel driveway back in Iowa has drained away, replaced by a certainty as pure and painful as that solitary calling owl's. She spreads her arms against the furrows. She's like a flea trying to hug its dog. Her face tilts straight up the titanic trunk.
I can't believe it. I can't believe there's no other way to protect this thing except with our bodies.
Loki says, if nobody's losing money or getting hurt, the law doesn't give a fuck.
The base of the tree, between two enormous burls, opens onto a charcoal-lined goose pen large enough to sleep all three of them tonight. Black soot marks run up the trunk, the scars of fires that burned long before there was an America. A tear in the lower crown recalls a lightning strike still fresh enough to ooze. And from high up in the tangled mass, vanishingly far above ground, come the cheers of two exhausted people out of their element who just want to be dry and warm and safe again tonight for a few hours. Something tumbles down from above. Watchman shouts and pulls Maidenhair aside. The snake flops down to the forest floor. A rope dangles in the air, the width of Watchman's index finger, in front of a shaft wider than his field of view.
What do we do with this? Attach the packs?
Loki chuckles.
You climb it.
He produces a harness, loops of knotted rope, and carabiners. He starts to put the belt of the harness around Watchman's waist.
Hang on. What's this? Are these staples?
There has been some wear. Don't worry. The staples and duct tape won't be bearing your weight.
No, this little shoestring here will be bearing my weight.
It has carried loads a lot heavier than you.
Olivia steps between the bickering men and takes the harness. She pulls it around her own waist. Loki clamps her in with carabiners. He cables her to the climbing rope with two sliding prussic knots, one for her chest and the other for a foot stirrup.
See? Your weight pulls these knots tight to the rope, like little fists. But when you release,
he slips one of the slack knots up the rope.
Stand up on the stirrup. Push the chest knot as high as you can. Lean back and let it take the weight. Sit back into the harness. Slip the stirrup knot as high as it will go, then stand up on that. Repeat.
Maidenhair laughs.
Like an inchworm?
Exactly like. She inches. She stands up. She leans back and sits. She stands and inches again, climbing a ladder of air, hoisting herself in self-raising footholds up off the face of the earth. Watchman stands underneath as she scoots up, seat of the pants, into the sky. The intimacy, her body writhing above him, makes his soul flush. She's the squirrel Ratatoskr, scaling Yggdrasil, carrying messages between hell, heaven, and here.
She's a natural, Loki says. She's flying. She'll reach the top in 20 minutes.
She does, though every muscle in her is shaking by arrival. From above, cheers greet her summit. Down at ground level, jealousy seizes Nick, and when the harness drops again, he springs into it. He gets about 100 feet into the air before freaking. The rope can't possibly hold him. It's twisting and making weird nylon groans. He cranes his neck to see how much farther. Forever. Then he makes the mistake of looking down. Loki twirls in slow circles below.
His face points upward like a tiny Pacific star flower about to be crushed underfoot. Watchman's muscles surrender to panic. He closes his eyes and whispers, "I can't do this. I'm dead." He feels the zoom, the endless drop coursing through his legs. Two small lumps of vomit come up his throat and onto his windbreaker.